Bienvenue sur Radio Créum. Welcome to Radio Créum. This is a special recording of the Breaking the Silence Conference on the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada that took place at the University of Montreal on September 26th and 27th in 2008. You will now hear part 8 of the recording, which features a plenary session with National Chief Phil Fontaine.
At this time, I'd like to introduce from the Assembly of First Nations, the National Chief, Mr. Phil Fontaine, and we welcome you onto the stage here.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Good to see so many people here this afternoon. I don't present myself as an expert on this matter that's under discussion, but I do offer myself as one individual with 10 years of residential school experience. I'm a survivor of the experience. I come from a large family, and of 12 actually, and two of my siblings, brothers, died at one at birth and another at one. 10 of us attended residential school. Mom and dad also residential school. My grandmother on my father's side attended an industrial school, the St. Boniface Industrial School. And so I come from a long line of residential school experiences. And I consider my experience unique, just as unique as all of the other residential school experiences that belong to every survivor that ever attended a boarding school, a residential school, or an industrial school. And I've resisted any and all attempts by people to deny the legitimacy of my experience. And it's because it's so very important to me, because I lived the experience. And it was about 20 years ago when I went public with my experience. I spoke about the abuse that had been inflicted on me, and I felt compelled to do so because I'd come to appreciate how very difficult this matter had become in our community, and in fact, the plague that it was and has been for as long as boarding schools, industrial schools, and residential schools have been around. And I understood that we needed to resolve this. I didn't have an appreciation of how we were going to fix this, but I knew that it had to become part of Canada. Canadians had to know about what was done to us. Canadians had to know and understand the what was done to innocent children. That much I knew. I knew it had to become part of the public record. And I knew that, given my own experience, that we had to engage in healing, right, to make ourselves better. I knew that, right? And I knew as well that perpetrators, the churches, and government had to acknowledge and accept their responsibility for this experience, and that at some point they had to apologize to us for what was done to so many, many people. I knew that, right? And I wasn't the first, right, that spoke about the residential school experience. I've never, ever made that claim. There were people before me. I wasn't the first that ever talked about a truth commission on the residential school experience. My good friend, who sits in the back of the room here, in fact, was one of the people that pushed for a truth commission when he was national chief for the Assembly of First Nations, and that's Matthew Kunkum. And so all of that is all of that is part of me, and I come here hopeful that whatever I have to say will advance the very important work that is before us, this huge challenge that's before the country. And so it's my view that in order to understand the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and this important undertaking, people should be at least not necessarily in the most detailed way, but you should understand a bit of the history that has brought us to this place. Because the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the idea, right, the TRC, and what we have before us, didn't come by accident, right? It didn't, no one came to us and said, hey, gosh, right? Lots of people have been harmed, so we need a truth commission, right? We have to fight for everything, right, we have. The residential school settlement agreement, the apology, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We fought for that. Right? Every inch of space we occupy today, we fought for that space. No one willingly came to us and said, this is what you need, this is what we're going to do for you, right? Because you deserve that. Not a chance. Not on your life, right? We fought for this. So anyone that chooses to try and discredit our efforts, I say to you, you're so wrong, right? You're so off base, and you don't know what you're talking about. Right? This is so very important to us. Right? It is so important to thousands of people. Thousands. Many, many of those thousands suffered abuse in the most horrible manner that you can imagine. And so the residential school settlement agreement, the largest settlement in Canadian history, the largest, at a minimum $5 billion, and the apology and the Truth Commission is important to all of those people. It is theirs, it belongs to them, and no one has the right to try and take that away from what rightfully belongs to those individuals. You'll recall, in 1998, we had the Statement of Reconciliation, right? Jane Stewart presented the Statement of Reconciliation on behalf of the previous government in Ottawa. And they brought together a number of us to witness the presentation by Minister Jane Stewart. And I remember Ralph Goodale, who was minister, was present as well. And we had it in one of the rooms. I think it might have been the railway room. And we had a ceremony. And we had a couple of elders, actually three elders. And the statement of reconciliation that was not in a parchment, but in a poster-like, was presented to each of us, or each of the five national leaders, right, of the Aboriginal organizations. And I remember thinking that this was quite significant, that we had actually advanced this issue, because it had been talked about, you know. We knew that it was this dark cloud that was hanging over our community, and so many people were troubled by this. And instinctively we knew that it wasn't enough, right? That government had to go beyond this. But at that point we accepted this as just so very important, because Canada, for the first time, acknowledged that it was responsible for what was done to our people, right? And that together with the $350 million that was offered us for healing was also of great significance for us. But many people complained that, you know, this wasn't enough, and all of the money that was included here wasn't going to do it. We knew that was true, right? But we didn't want to present ourselves as accepting this in a way that would discourage anyone. We wanted people to feel emboldened by this. We wanted survivors to see this as an opportunity to finally fix this huge problem, right? And we knew that one of the results would be that the floodgates would open up, right? Because up until 1998, there were a few court cases, right? Most of the actions that had been undertaken by survivors were civil suits. We knew that this would open up. And sure enough, people started filing claims, right? Started charging the perpetrators of these criminal acts. And then at some point, the government started becoming really worried, because the courts were starting to bog down, until the point where there were at least 12,000 claims before the courts, right? And so the government was struggling about what to do about these claims. So they came to me as national chief and asked me what ideas, if any, I had about this, right, or the Assembly of First Nations. So we went to a meeting. We talked about a process other than the courts, right, because we were afraid, very afraid, that survivors that had suffered painful experiences would be re-victimized through the court process, this adversarial process. And we said, look, you need something else, right? And so we came up with the alternative dispute resolution process. Right? And the program that emerged came about through these dialogue sessions that were held in various parts of the country. The government took that on, set aside, I think, $1.7 billion to try and address these many, many claims, right? But all of this was very much flawed, right? And in fact, government was spending so much money maintaining the system that it was of little value to survivors. We discovered that the government is spending $4 for every dollar they're paying out in compensation. $4. We also discovered that it was going to take about 59 years, or 57, right, to complete this process. Right? 57 years. And that most, if not all, maybe someone like me who's still pretty young, you know, would come to experience this 50 years hence, right? 57 years later, that everyone would be dead, right? By the time this was resolved. So we said, look, you need something else. This is so flawed. And we kept getting pushed back, right, by officials, senior officials in the ministry, and said, don't say flawed. That sends the wrong message. Don't say flawed. We kept saying flawed, right? And then we added another word, deeply flawed, right? And so we decided, look, this is not working. Not only the courts are re-victimizing our people, but this process is doing the same darn thing that we were not supposed to do, right? Which is re-victimize the survivors. So we convened a meeting in Calgary. We brought together about 250 people, experts, right? Of truth commissions, church representatives, elders, government officials, survivors, and of course our organization. We sat there for 3 days, taking a very careful look at the ADR, right? And we commissioned papers. People came to present their findings on the Truth Commission. I mean, on the ADR process. At the end of this, it became obvious, with all of the people present there, that we needed something other than the ADR. So I took the deputy minister aside, a fellow by the name of Mario Dion. And I said, look, Mario, we need to fix this. And we can do it. I said, I can put together the best minds in the country, and we'll go out and do a very careful examination of all of the different experiences, similar to ours here. And I said, I need some money to do that. And he said, okay, how much do you need? And I gave him a figure, and I put the team together. And one of the places they went to, our team of experts, was Ireland. And they looked at the Irish experience. Came back, and we put a report together right after this review and examination. That report became the basis for a political agreement that we signed with the previous government on May the 30th, 2005. Political agreement had all of the elements in the AFN report that we tabled in November 2004, right, where we brought together survivors and government people at the Lord Elgin Hotel, actually. And what the political agreement had, right, as its main elements, a common experience payment, commemoration, additional support to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, an apology, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and an improved ADR process. The apology itself was, you know, we put it over here, right? But it was all contained in the political agreement that we negotiated. The Assembly of First Nations negotiated this. The report that was tabled in November 2004 was ours, the Assembly of First Nations. We'd been fighting this issue for so long, right? And sometimes we felt so alone, right? We couldn't get, we couldn't capture the country's interest, right, on this. And we thought that, you know, where are all these people that believe in human rights and justice and fair treatment and right, and that believe in kids, right? We felt very much alone, right? But we carried on, we struggled, we knew we were right, because we were with survivors, right? We were supported by survivors, and the chiefs of Canada supported us, right? So we pressed on, and we ended up with this political agreement that we signed on May the 30th, 2005, right? But little known fact in regards to the political agreement is that I was part of the federal government's official delegation. See you later, Violet. That went to the funeral for John Paul II. And Jean Charest, Premier Charest, was part of that. Stephen Harper, the official leader of the official opposition party. Sheila Martin, Paul Martin, so the Prime Minister, Right Honorable Paul Martin. Myself, right, as part of the Canadian delegation. And the first night that we were in Rome, and the Prime Minister invited us out for dinner, the entire group, right? There are others that were present, members of parliament from all of the political parties, media and whatnot, and we went out for dinner. But before we went out for dinner, we were escorted from the airplane, we were met with security people. God, I felt good. You know, lights going, geez, you know. I'd never had that experience. And so they checked us into this pretty nice hotel in Rome. And I remember everybody, the Prime Minister, of course, had this entourage, and he had his bags taken up. I carried my own bags and opened the door to this room, right? And I looked around for the light switch. I didn't see any light switch anywhere. And so I'd opened the door, right? And sort of rush inside, right, before the door closed to get some light, because I struggled, right, at least 15 minutes there trying to find the light switch. And so finally I decided I'm going to put my bag against the door, get some light there. And because for one thing, I didn't even know how to phone downstairs. I couldn't find the phone to begin with. And so I looked around and I finally saw this slot, right? That's where you're supposed to put your tea. Hey, light, right? But only for the front part. The other part was still dark, right? And eventually I found it. It was on the console, the telephone thing. And anyway, big time moment for me in Rome. And I didn't tell anyone about my experience for a long time. Anyway, we go for dinner, and Prime Minister Martin and I are talking. And interestingly enough, the now Justice Minister is also sitting there, okay? Rob Nicholson, Jason Kenney, Ethel Blondin. And the Prime Minister and I are talking about residential schools, right, and compensation, because we had been pushing for compensation. And he would call me. He came over to my office once, which was quite an unbelievable experience for me. And then he turned to me after, I think he was convinced that this had to be resolved through a settlement, right? And that there had to be compensation. And he made a commitment to me then, right, that we would get this done, right? And he was true to his word, right? And so when we came back, there was a big change in the attitude and approach of the government. And the word became, when justice officials would talk about the negotiations process, say, and then the Pope died, right? And then the Pope died. And true enough. And so that became an important piece in this settlement process. But what is also an important piece, and you should know this, right? Given the fact that the government was spending $4 for every buck they were putting out in compensation, and we knew that it was just so for example, the $1.7 billion that they set aside for this, $800 million was for administration, $900 million for compensation. Right? And so something had to be done. So the big thing we did was we put a business case together. Right? And we hired, the guy's a genius. He's a lawyer, but he's also a mathematician. And so he put together this argument, this business case. And that's what ultimately led to the negotiations that brought forward the agreement in principle that we signed on November the 21st, 2005, right? And as noted by Kathleen Mahoney, Professor Mahoney, she was the chief negotiator for the settlement agreement. And we had a team, a very, very good team, survivors, elders, lawyers, and political direction. And keep in mind that this was a complicated process, because it's a complex issue. At one of the meetings, there were at least 80 lawyers around the room, right? And we won this one, right? The settlement agreement, as much as some would like to argue that, well, it's just money or it's just, you know, giving into Canada's legal framework, it's a huge victory, right? Because the elements that are contained in the settlement agreement, we couldn't even dream about them, right? We couldn't even imagine that at some point we would have a common experience payment, a lump sum payment for every living survivor as of May the 30th, that we would have an independent process, much improved over the ADR, with a minimum of $2.2 billion and the common experience, $1.9 billion, right? And then, in addition to that, a truth commission, a commitment for truth and reconciliation commission. And as I said, this wasn't given to us. This wasn't offered to us. We fought for this. AFN fought for this, right? At the end, the only other interest group in the settlement process that supported this call were the churches, right? Were the churches. United Church, Anglican Church, the Presbyterian Church, and the Catholic Church entities. Everybody else that was in at the table could care less, right? Could care less about a truth commission, could care less about an apology. Have you heard one word by any lawyer other than our people say something positive, anything positive about the apology, or anything about the truth commission? And this is after they were able to realize millions and millions of dollars in legal fees for their work for survivors. So don't fool yourself, right? I'm saying that to those people, right? Or try and convince people that you cared. This was ours. This belongs to the survivors. Right? Truth and Reconciliation Commission is so important, right? Because we knew that once all the money was gone, right? Once all of the money was gone, that we would be left with this. This is, in fact, the lasting legacy of the residential school settlement package. This will live on forever. And so you must consider this together with the apology. The apology was a moment in time for us, a momentous occasion for the country. We couldn't dream that we would be where we were on June the 11th. As we said then, we achieved the impossible. Right? We were on the floor, the House of Commons, speaking in our own right with our own voice. Right? And we spoke to the country. Right? And so the apology should be seen as a staging point, right, for the next important part of this long, difficult process, right? It sets the stage for reconciliation, right? It sets the stage for reconciliation so that real healing can be achieved. That's what it's about. That's why it's so incredibly important. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in addition to being about reconciliation, it's about writing the missing chapter in Canadian history, right? This dark, sad chapter in our collective history, in our shared history. And it's so very important, and I'll tell you why. Commissioner Morley mentioned the poll that was done. 83% of Canadians surveyed said they were aware of the apology, which means 100% essentially, right? 73% said they supported the apology, which is absolutely fantastic, right? And so what is obvious there is that there's this incredible goodwill among Canadians. Canadians that are essentially fair-minded people and believe in fairness, right? To do something constructive for the country. And there isn't anything more constructive than writing this chapter, right? So the Truth Commission, as pointed out, it's not a public inquiry, right? And it's not about naming names. It's not about subpoena powers. It's not about lawyers controlling this process. It's about providing an opportunity for the survivors and all of the other unique perspectives that factor into this experience to come before the commission to share the truth of their experiences. And it's so broadly based that we will be able to achieve success in this. Because as also pointed out, the churches and the government have committed to opening up the records for the first time in our history. Until now, the churches refused. Until now, the government refused. Well, that's no longer the case. And remember that the churches kept meticulous records. You think the Hudson's Bay records are meticulous. The church records are even more meticulous. So, I mean, everything that happened on a daily basis in these schools is written down, right? Names of individuals, right? What happened in the communities? I mean, I'm reading about my community. In 1948, I'd heard about this. There was a lightning strike on one house, right? It was actually my great uncle. There was a lightning strike during Sunday Mass, right? And they could hear this large clap. And La Louise, my grandmother, and her sister-in-law, Clara, were at church, and they described the service and what happened, right? And that's just a detail, trivia for most people, but important for a lot of people, right? And it's in there, right? This particular document that I was looking at, and so we're going to have access to that. And this thing about making public all of the gruesome details, right? Talking about all of the horrible things that happened to individuals. The thing that guided us, and this is so very important, everywhere we went, whenever we talked to survivors, they said, look, we don't want to go to the courts, right? Because that's an adversarial process. I don't want to be re-victimized, right? And keeping in mind that one of the things that precipitated this is that there are already 12,000 claims before the courts, and our estimated number that will be before the courts, right, that would have been before the courts, is 26,000. So if you're interested in all of the horrible details on this, you would have had all kinds of fun with that, right? Because all of that would have been described in incredible detail in the most adversarial manner imaginable. Survivors didn't want that. They wanted to be assured of their safety and their comfort, right? And that is why we structured it the way we did. Not to give in to Canada, not to concede to Canada's legal framework, right? We were thinking about the survivors. That's what motivated us, right? Because, keep in mind, when you talk about details, when you talk about all of the, you know, the perpetrators, who they are, what they did, when they did it, how many times they did it, all of that is in the IAP, right? Independent assessment process. That's where all of this detail that some people want, right, is presented. And that, you can rest assured, is a very painful process for a lot of survivors. All you have to do is talk to legal counsel that are involved in this process. They will tell you the tears that are shed. They will tell you how very emotional this process is. And to think that there are people out there that wanted to subject survivors to that kind of process, think again. Right? Think very carefully about what would have been the result, survivors. It would have been tough. Right? It would have been tough. But that's not to suggest that we aren't going to be able to uncover all of that, right? Because we know the perpetrators. Most of the perpetrators are known. Plus, most of them are dead, right? Most of them are dead. So, I urge a bit of caution here. Especially when the talk turns around to how limited this commission is, right? We don't see it as limited. We see it as representing an incredible opportunity to finally set this aside, right? But in a way that it becomes a real part of Canadian history, right? So that real healing can be achieved, so that reconciliation becomes a part of our collective experience. That's what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is about, right? And it's quite a moment for us. But in order to make it as good as it needs to be, the commission has to be truly independent. It's not a church commission. It's not a government commission. It's survivors' commission. It's ours, right? It's our Truth Commission, right? And we will have an opportunity to share the truth of our experiences, right? Both at the national events process as well as the community-based Truth Commission initiative. But to underline my point, the commission has to be truly independent, has to be strong, the commissioners have to work together, government must not be allowed to interfere in the work of the commission. And we should, but at the same time, we have to move away from this notion that we are presiding over a trial, right? This isn't a trial. It's not a public inquiry. It's a truth commission. And the commissioners there are going to preside over truth-sharing experiences, right? People are going to come and talk. And this talk about impartiality. Impartiality is not central to this initiative because the IAP process addresses that. In fact, the commission has to be partial to the interest of the survivors because this truth commission is about the survivors. Right? That's why we have to be careful when you talk about the impartiality of the Truth Commission. And I want to state for the record here that we support 100% the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We support the commissioners. We support very much the consensus approach to decisions that have to be taken by the commission. There isn't one commissioner that's above the other two. They're all, three of them are commissioners, true. One is called the chief commissioner. But what that means is that that person chairs the process, right, and the proceedings. But for decision making, they hold the same power. And we're really worried that, and I hope and pray that Chief Commissioner Justice LaForme, who's at present not well, will be healthy soon enough so that we can begin the very important work that we all need to support. Thank you very much. Miigwech.